Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Heredy, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. And if you enjoy this podcast, tell your friends you heard from us, and please leave a 5-star rating wherever you're listening now. And now, here's your host, Eli Mazur.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by USPTO Director Kathy Vidal, who obviously needs no introduction, but she happens to be the first returning guest on the Clause 8 podcast. Thank you so much for joining Clause 8.
Thank you for having me here.
Since I know you're super busy, we're going to jump right into the questions. When I first interviewed you and you were nominated to be USPTO Director, a lot of people came to me and asked, how did you know? How did you know she was going to be USPTO Director one day? And I said, I didn't know, but it seemed like a great choice. But when did you know? When did you know you might be USPTO Director one day?
So it's interesting because this was not a position that I was vying for or talking to people about. And then I was asked about a year before I received an email from the White House whether I would serve if called upon to do so. And I thought about it hard. I spoke to my family and I just realized there's so much to do that although I was very happy in what I was doing, that of course I would serve if asked to do so. So when I actually knew it was a real possibility was when I received an email from the White House asking me if I could talk to them.
Did you know how you came on the radar about somebody who'd be great for that role?
I do not. A number of people spoke to me, as I said, about a year before I got that email. So I don't know how things work behind the scenes. And I know they were talking to a lot of other candidates and eventually emailed me.
So it seemed like you were pretty clear that there's a lot of good work to be doing as USPTO director, but is there anything that made you hesitate on taking on that role?
Once I thought about it, no. As I said, it wasn't something that I was aspiring to do, not because it's not an incredible opportunity to make impact for the country, but because I'm always happy in whatever I'm doing at the moment and really focused on doing the best job I can at whatever I'm doing. So once I actually thought about it and the impact that I could have in this position, the ability to work across stakeholders in government to make real change, there was no question that I would take it if offered it.
And I think you were actually friends with Michelle Lee, who's a previous USPTO director in a previous administration. Is there anything that you learned from her time as USPTO director or any other USPTO directors that you kind of thought about when you were taking on this role?
Well, and I appreciate that. I knew a number of the prior USPTO directors going way back, and I would say that each director really brings their own self to the position, their own abilities and capabilities, and they don't perfectly overlap between any director, but that's what makes a system great. And in terms of what I learned from them, it's just, you know, put the country first and do your best job.
And once you find out that you were the number one choice for the Biden administration to be USPTO director, how did you kind of prepare for that role?
Yeah, Eli, that's a really good point. So I prepared exhaustively for it. So luckily, I was at a law firm that allowed me to do that. For all the months that I was preparing, both for my hearing as well as after the hearing, I just studied everything I could possibly get my hands on, everything that was public. As you know, with requests for comments, a lot of the feedback is public. So I started reading through all of those and just trying to make sure that I was as educated as possible on the key issues when the day came, if it did come.
And did you have already in mind about, I guess, what you wanted to do as USPTO director at the time or shortly after you were given the opportunity to think about that?
So I would say that what I had in mind was very big picture. So I thought about the U.S. economy, our need to be competitive, jobs, you know, making sure that startups can be successful. And I thought about competition with other countries and some of the ways that other countries look at intellectual property and the role we could play, you know, in the international sphere. So that's what I thought about. I was also very cognizant that I had limited experience only in that only, you know, one person can only have so much experience with industry. So I represented certain industries, I represented startups, and I wanted to make sure that I didn't overly rely on my own background and that I really heard from all stakeholders. And I think, you know, that was the approach that I took. So I didn't think about any particular solution other than big picture, here's what I want to accomplish, and I need to hear how that's going to impact all the different stakeholders and what's going to be best for the country.
And that's interesting because we're all kind of in our own somewhat bubble, right? Can you give us a sense, what did you learn in that process? of any blind spots that you might have had before you started thinking of taking on that role?
So one thing I learned was when I first started meeting with stakeholders, it was initially on the it was initially around SEPs, because we had the statement, you know, the 2021 statement was floating around. There was a 2019 statement that was active, and then there was a 2013 statement. And so when I first started meeting with stakeholders, I assumed that they would do what I first saw stakeholders doing, which was just doubling down on their comments and really taking binary positions on these things, really taking the position that best supported their industry. And what I found was incredible was, as soon as I started saying, look, I'm not here to support any one industry, I'm not, the chance that a solution is going to be, you know, fully supportive of one industry and ignoring other industries or other size companies, it's not likely we're ever going to land there. So can we talk about what you really need from this and how you think this can also serve others? And I will say, I've been delighted. And most all of my stakeholder listening sessions, they really focused on, you know, what's best for the country. And part of that is how I can help their industry while helping others. So I was delighted about that, but that was not something that I expected. I of course, didn't think about it one way or the other, but it was great to hear.
I'm interested to hear, because I wasn't even planning to discuss it, but the outcome of that was somewhat surprising because the administration ended up withdrawing all the statements on the policy. How did that come about? Can you give some sense about, after talking to all these stakeholders, that was the right decision to do that?
So it was interesting because the more I heard from stakeholders, the more I realized that the prior statements, the 2013 and the 2019 statements, were being used against U.S. industry. So they were well-intentioned. I think they were written with the right goals in mind. But at the end of the day, they did not have effective law. But other countries would use them against U.S. industry to say, oh, look what your government is saying. And they would misuse them against industry. So as we thought about that, you know, within the USPTO, it didn't really make sense to have a statement. And so we thought hard about that. And then it turned out that once we all got together in a room, and this is, you know, Cantor at the DOJ and Lori LoCascio at NIST, we were all on board with the best solution was really to withdraw the statement and make it clear that we do want to focus on standards. They're critically important. We need U.S. policy around standards. We need more U.S. involvement, not only in standard setting organization, but in implementing standards, that's the role we wanted to play, that we did not want to play the role of trying to rearticulate what the law is and create policy statements that did not have effective law and that could be used against us.
And what did you think of the overall state of the patent system, I guess, after you talked to all these stakeholders about the health of the patent system as a whole?
So first of all, I think the patent system is very healthy in this country right now. I do think that there's a lot of dialogues out there that suggest that it's not. And I think the only thing that could, first of all, I do think we need to make improvements at the margins. And that's something that I took on immediately. I'm working with stakeholders on that, whether it comes to robust and reliable patents, whether it comes to the PTAB, other areas, trademarks, and some of the abuses there. We're doing everything we can to make the system even better. The other part of it is we need to make sure that there's a positive dialogue out there around the core role, especially the patent system plays when it comes to innovation, because there's a lot of information out there that may discourage people from using the IP system, and that would not inure to the country's benefit. So overall, it's working very well. Can it work better? Yes, we're working on that. We're working with Congress on that. We're working with the courts on that, across government on that, and seeing what we can do to move the country forward.
One of the things that you mentioned that you took a look at when you were preparing for the role is kind of to see how competitive we are with other countries. And obviously, you know, other countries have their own patent systems. And one of the news coverage that you hear is an American company had to go to country X to kind of enforce their patent rights. Do you have any views about how does America's patent system stack up against other countries' patent systems? And is that an issue? Is that an issue that American companies have to rely on other countries' patent systems to kind of enforce their global patent rights?
So, and I appreciate that question, Eli. So you, we are the gold standard. There are a lot of other countries who have great systems like ours as well. And the work that we're doing across countries is to help other countries basically create their IP systems, make sure they have the right enforcement mechanisms in place so that our stakeholders have easy access in those systems as well. So we're doing that with our IP attaché program across the world. That's a phenomenal program. U.S. companies can talk directly to our IP attachés to figure out how to navigate the IP systems in other countries, but also it gives us a chance to work hard on working with those other countries on capacity building, making sure that they have the tools necessary and the rules necessary to have the same type of strong IP system that we have.
Well, I guess I'm asking the flip side of that. The flip side of that is American companies have to rely on other countries because they don't think they're getting the same kind of robust ability to enforce their patent rights in the U.S. I don't know if you agree with that sentiment, but that is a sentiment out there that, and there are news stories about how companies do that. Do you think that's a problem? Or maybe no, because, you know, we have our gold standard here. Companies come up with all kinds of strategies to do all kinds of things, but I just wanted to get your thoughts if you thought that was an issue or not.
So I will say that one thing is, you know, certainly our patent eligibility law is different than in other countries. So to the extent that that needs to be addressed, we're working really hard on that to make sure that that we do have the ability to protect new innovation. And so that may be one area where if you're seeing people going to other countries, that may be part of the reason. In terms of litigation, that's a whole nother landscape. And certainly other countries may have the ability to get an injunction more readily than in the U.S. Certainly our damages awards tend to be higher than in other countries. So you're going to see companies going where it makes sense for them to go.
Was there one issue that you thought you wanted to tackle as USPTO director above all? Is there something that kind of stood out to you?
Eli, there's never one issue for me. So, and I think you know this from our prior conversation. So if you look at all that's coming out of the USPTO, we're working on all the issues. We have a very big priority list. We're moving swiftly and very thoughtfully in a lot of different vectors. You know, certainly when it comes to designs, we've got more work in the hopper right now to make sure that we lift design so that it is the independent protection that it should be in the U.S. just as in other countries. Certainly with robust and reliable IP, we're working across the board on that. There's a lot of fraud out there, abuses, we're working on that. So I can't say that there's one thing other than if I were to abstract all of that up, we need a system that people can have faith in, that they will use so that they can get IP protection and can secure the funding to bring products to market and solve world problems. So all of those feed into that.
One issue that obviously I think you've talked a lot about is the need to increase the diversity of patent applicants, increase the number of female inventors who take advantage of the patent system. Talk a little bit about that.
Of course, it's important for our country. So we have people sitting on the bench who have incredible ideas and just don't know what to do with them. They're not aware of the IP ecosystem. They don't know how to protect their IP. They don't know how to get funding. They don't know how to start companies or license their ideas to others. And so, and if you look at it demographically, that tends to be people who are underrepresented, whether it be women, whether it be people from certain you know, ethnic or minority groups, whether it be people in certain areas of the country or people who fall within a certain income range or people from the military, veterans. So there are a lot of people who are not fully participating in our IP ecosystem. And the only way to really drive jobs and competition and, you know, make the country the great country that it is when it comes to startups and innovation and great ideas is to make sure that everybody's participating. And that means that the focus is not just on the tech hubs. I mean, of course, we want more innovation everywhere, including from those who are already innovating. But we need to make sure that we create a system that everybody has access to so that they can share their ideas and we can build upon them.
And obviously, this was an issue that the previous administration also thought was very important. I guess, what did you think of those efforts and what else did you think need to be done?
Well, and I will say with regard to administrations, one of the great things about patent and trademark and IP generally is that it's less partisan. And so what we're really doing is standing on the shoulders of others. So you mentioned the previous administration, but this goes way back. I mean, Dave Kaplis was one of the first ones who started pro bono and really worked to develop that. And there were many initiatives that started before him that he stood on their shoulders in developing what he developed. So when I look at what we need to do, I really want to move swiftly and impactfully and scale the work. So we've doubled down on pro bono. Dave Kaplis is part of the advisory group on that. We are expanding pro bono. You're going to hear some more announcements in March on expanding the efforts throughout the entire country on pro bono. But when it comes to getting out there and reaching people, we need to look at the system a little bit differently than we have in the past and make sure that we're out and meeting people where they are, that we're not just talking on our channels. I mean, that's a great start. We prime the pump immensely on that. That's part of the reason with our Council for Inclusive Innovation that we're now doing an all of government approach, that we're working with MBDA, Minority Business Development Agency, that we're working with other areas of commerce, that we're working with the Small Business Association, that we're figuring out where do people who have business needs or have great ideas, where do they connect with the U.S. government and how can we serve them there? And then even beyond that, if they're not coming to the U.S. government, how do we meet them in their community? So it's a big challenge, and it's something that, again, we're building off of the work that has happened in the past and just trying to figure out how we can scale that even more.
That's an interesting point. Obviously, the USPTO has great programs to help diverse applicants, but they diverse applicants never hear about them, then it doesn't do much good. Have you seen progress? Has it been working, the different initiatives, in terms of increasing the number of diverse applicants?
So we haven't had enough data yet to collect that, to look at what that looks like. But what I will say is, here's some stats that I think show that we are making progress. So when we get out there and meet people where they are with free legal services through our pro bono programs, the statistics on the demographics are dramatic. So right now, the number of women inventors on patents is between 12 and 13%. When we get out there and meet people where they are, it jumps to 41% women. It's 30% African Americans. It's 15% Hispanic, 5.6% Asian American and Native Hawaiian, and 1.5% Native American. So that we don't have that data with U.S. patents, but we know it doesn't look anything like that. So that just shows that when we get out there, we meet people in their communities through our pro bono services and through other services, there are innovators everywhere and they just need access.
One thing I want to talk about, and I think you kind of hit it, you know, the last 2 years in Congress have been pretty relatively active in terms of hearing a lot about IP issues from the Senate IP subcommittee. And you've seen a similar level of activity, I guess, from the USPTO. It seems like there was a lot of alignment. Can you give us a sense? Were you able to work together with the senators, or is it just a coincidence that you guys had a lot of similar views and a lot of priorities? Can you give us a sense of how that comes about?
Yeah, I'm happy to. And I have to say, I am so proud and excited to be serving in government right now, because I feel like now is the time. Everybody is aligned. We understand the importance of IP to our economy. We know what we have to do. The senators are aligned with that. Representatives I've met with are aligned with that. Across government, I love working with DOJ. I just met with the USDA this week. I'm working with the FDA. I mean, across government, we all have the same intentions in mind. We need the system to work. We need to create jobs. We need to make sure that we get products and solutions into the hands of all Americans. And so I don't think we could be more aligned. I've never served in another administration, but I think the fact that we're so aligned is why we're moving so quickly and we're able to get so much out there and make so much progress.
I think you mentioned, you know, overall, the America's patent system is pretty healthy. It's doing well. And you said, you know, on the margins, there are things that need to be changed. But how do you, I guess, weigh the importance of stability of what people expect from the patent system versus, all right, this is the change we should make? If we were designing a patent system from scratch, maybe it would have made sense to have that. But like, how do you kind of weigh that? How do you think about that?
Well, and the way I think about it is we need to be very thoughtful in how we roll things out, and we need to make sure we get stakeholder input and not to create policy rashly. So if you look at everything we've done, it's interim and then final. So even with director review, you know, I made it very clear exactly how that was going to work going forward. We put that as interim. We've received feedback on that. We asked for feedback on that. And now we're going to go into rulemaking. So there aren't going to be changes that are going to be made that are going to be, you know, whole scale undoing the patent system and creating something new. It's going to be something that we're going to be working on with stakeholders, hearing feedback, and then trying to thread the needle and really figure out how can we create something that works, that people can have confidence in, even more confidence in going forward. So so in everything we look at, even with, you know, expanding the patent bar, potentially creating a design bar, changing the bar when it comes to, or changing who can practice before the PTAB, you know, those may have seemed like rash things if we just immediately put something in place and changed it, but we didn't. We announced our intentions. We've been very open about everything that we're doing. Every time I speak, I'm happy to chat about anything that we're doing. And then we're seeking feedback on it and making sure that as we move forward, we're taking feedback into consideration. I'll just say one other thing. Even with DocX, I mean, that's something that we've heard a lot from stakeholders on. We want to solve for that. So sometimes we'll pivot a little bit, or we'll pause, or we'll extend something, because it's more important to us to get things right at the end of the day, even if we have to change a little bit in order to do that. So we're trying to be as thoughtful and careful as possible.
You mentioned Director Kappos. You know, I think he was talking to me the other day about he seems a bit concerned about the number of requests for comments, and he thinks that's destabilizing to the PAN system. Is that the correct way to view a request for comments? Is just because there's a request for comments, does it mean that the USPTO is thinking about implementing something? Or does it mean there's just an idea out there and, you know, the USPTO wants to hear the views? Which one is it?
So it's both. It's both. So, you know, in terms of the request for comments, that's the only way to make meaningful change. And meaningful change does need to be made. And then when it comes to requests for comments, like there was one recently where senators asked a number of questions and wanted to get feedback on it. So we threw it in the request for comment. Is that an indication we plan to move forward on any of that? It's not an indication one way or the other. It's just there were comments out there and people need to understand how the public reacts to them. When we throw out requests for comments, sometimes it's just to validate that we want to move in a different direction, that something that a stakeholder has proposed is not where we want to go, but we want to hear from people on that to see if we've missed something. So it's not at all an indication that any one thing that we ask a question on is something we're planning to move forward on. It's more, here's what we're hearing from stakeholders. Directionally, yes, if we do a request for comment on robust and reliable patents, is it likely we will move into rulemaking on something related to robust and reliable patents? Absolutely, or we wouldn't be wasting people's time on it. But in terms of individual questions, I wouldn't read too much into them.
But do you think there's, any problem with too many? Because obviously, you know, most stakeholders have limited resources and they have to kind of pick and choose where they're going to weigh in, what they're going to consider, and so forth. Do you think too many requests for comments is an issue, or is that something that you've thought about?
I don't think it is. I mean, certainly if someone thinks it is, they can certainly communicate to us about that. But I would rather...
A request for comments about a request for comments.
Exactly. Well, to me, it's the only way to make sustainable change. And we know that people would prefer this. We've heard in the past, in terms of the processes, that, you know, in generally, stakeholders don't want decisions to just come out. In general, they want the ability to chime in. They want the ability to answer questions to make sure that we are taking their input into consideration. Now, certainly, if we ask a number of them, people can prioritize if there's things that matter to them more than other things. But it's really the only way to move forward thoughtfully. And so I plan to continue it as long as we need the feedback in order to move things forward.
So I just want to ask a question about one of these requests for comments. It's, I think there was some legislation that proposed recording examiner interviews, and I think it's now planned in the request for comments. Can you share your thoughts, preliminary thoughts about that idea, about whether recording examiner interviews is a good idea or not?
So I don't have a personal view on that. My view is it's going to be better for the entire system if we have a clearer record at the USPTO. How we get there, we're seeking stakeholder feedback on. And as you mentioned, there was some proposed legislation on that. Sometimes when we see that, we'll throw it into request for comment just so that the whole country, you know, the legislatures, those of us at the USPTO can understand how people might react to that, what benefits we could achieve through whatever the proposal is, and what some of the drawbacks are. So in terms of how we're moving forward, we don't decide and then get comments to validate what we've thought. We really are seeking feedback on what is the best way to have a clearer record so that moving forward, people can license because they understand exactly what the patents cover or as best as possible they can understand it. If they have to litigate, litigation can be more efficient. So we are working on that. Like I said, any one proposal or question that we ask is more, hey, this was floated. This was a big one. It was floated in legislation, and we'd like to hear your feedback on that.
And have you heard internally from the USPTO, maybe the union or so forth, about their thoughts about that proposal about recording examiner interviews?
So we do work with the unions very closely, and now when it would be POPA and Kathy Duda leading that, very closely on all of this. So they look at the requests for comments before we send them out. We will not move forward with anything before we talk to them and we negotiate with them around what something might look like if it impacts our examiners. I'm thrilled that we have both the union and management, making sure that the examiner's workload makes sense and then and looking out for examiners. So that is one where we've not gotten to that point because we don't yet have a proposal on how we want to move forward.
You mentioned kind of the media coverage and about your concern that negative media coverage discourages inventors. Are there any positive stories that I guess you hear that you think are not being told enough? Is there anything that kind of sticks out to you?
I would say it falls within two buckets. One is just the great stories about how the system works. So, you know, we've got our Journeys of Innovation series. We launched We Women Entrepreneurship. We're bringing entrepreneurs into the system to help other entrepreneurs. And, you know, the more we can do that, the better. The other part of it is there's so much lobbying around intellectual property right now and so many stories that are being told and you know, relying on data that they believe they have. And my thought on all that is that's fine, but we also need to get the positive story out. So, you know, even around COVID, if there was not a strong patent system, we would have never gotten to where we did with regard to the vaccine. We needed mRNA to start out. And then we needed all the developments on top of that. And we needed patents so that companies could collaborate. Because if you don't have patents, people keep things trade secret, right? They need to make sure that they can get a return on investment for all the great work that they're doing. And then if you look at something like the over-the-counter test for COVID, right now we don't have the ability to patent something like that. That would be very difficult. So we're not seeing evolution in that space. The over-the-counter test now tests for variants, you know, many variants ago. So it just reinforces the importance of a strong IP system. And I wish there was more out there supporting that. It's not just us, just by the way, it's other countries as well. Europe is dealing with this. You know, other allies are dealing with this as well in terms of making sure that the right dialogue is out there around intellectual property so that everybody knows that it's key to protecting what they're doing, to, you know, obtaining investment in what they're doing and bringing their ideas to impact.
Now, it's interesting you bring up because I discussed it actually on my podcast before about how the COVID vaccine miracle and about how like it happened because of the U.S. patent system. You think that would have been the story that came out of the whole pandemic? Do you have any thoughts about why that wasn't the case? Why you kind of, if anything, you heard negative stories about how, you know, COVID, how the patent system is preventing the rollout of vaccines and so forth. Is there anything that kind of, do you have any theories about the media coverage regarding that?
Yeah, I really don't have any thoughts on that. I just, you know, there's media coverage on a lot of different things, and certainly people want to make sure that everybody has access to life-saving treatments, life-saving vaccines, et cetera. So I think it was driven more by that than anything else. But I think if people reflect, I mean, they wouldn't even be there if we didn't have the strong patent system. And I know that companies that were creating these vaccines did a lot to make sure that those vaccines got out there. And they're equally aligned with making sure that, you know, that these treatments and these vaccines get into the hands of those who need them.
People hear stories about individual inventors. And, you know, when I heard your comments about that in April, I'm like, am I part of the problem? Because, you know, for example, on this season of the Clauseed podcast, one of the stories that I featured is, you know, Molly Metz. She invented a jump rope after getting into a car accident. She's a 5-time world champion. She started a company based on that. She should have been like a success story that the USPTO could have heralded. And at the end of the day, her patents got invalidated by the PTAB. What do you tell to other inventors who hear her story and say, I don't want to be the next Molly Metz if I spend all this time and effort applying for patents? What would you tell those other inventors?
Well, and I do. So first of all, I can't talk about anything that's kind of an ongoing dispute in courts. So I'll just footnote that. But I will say just generally, I do talk to a lot of inventors about that. And, you know, I let them know that the system works for the most part. Does it work every time? It may or may not. I mean, there's improvements we can make when it comes to the system generally, but they need to know that the IP system is necessary for the work that they're doing, that they need to get the patent to get investment, that they need to get the patent to make sure that they are protecting what they do against those who may later infringe on it, who may later copy what they're doing, that they need to get the trademark to differentiate themselves. So overall, the system is working. And even when you hear stories, you don't know if the system is, the system may still be working. So just because in one situation a patent gets invalidated doesn't mean it's not working, because if there are patents out there that really should not have issued if we were aware of all the prior art, et cetera, then that is the system working. So I don't want to speak to any particular circumstance, but I am open to hearing from everybody on that, from people who think that it could have worked better to their benefit, and for people who have real ideas on how we can fix the system. So I've been in contact with inventor groups, many of them, the ones that you hear about. I'm trying to solve for things that I think can help, and I think you'll see that coming up.
I mean, do you think the expectations of inventors need to be more realistic? Just because you get one or two patents doesn't mean, you know, you'll be able to, you're guaranteed to enforce your rights, or I don't know, whatever they are, because, you know, if you talk to a litigation funder or an NPE, they would never just buy one or two patents if they're going to have an enforcement campaign. Do you think like the expectations or what it means to own one or two patents need to be reset, or no?
You know, I would hope that all inventors get the same sage advice that those who have a lot of resources get, whether it comes to one or two patents, whether it comes to continuation practice, whether it comes to, using ex parte re-exam or using other processes to make sure that they're protecting their patents. So I would say on all of that, that's why I'm excited in part about our pro bono programs, is that people can go to those programs. They can ask whatever questions they want, even if the programs are focused more on the prosecution side of things. So I don't think a wholesale adjustment is needed. I just think making sure people get the right advice from the beginning, that they get the right counseling, and if they can't afford it, for us to do whatever we can as a society to make sure that they get it.
And obviously on the other side of the narrative that you hear about the patent system is the patent troll narrative, right? That there's way too many bad patents out there that are being enforced and that something needs to be done about it. Do you think that narrative is, how do you think that narrative, do you think it's problematic for the patent system?
So I will say all the narratives, I mean, you mentioned a couple of them in the last few minutes. All the narratives are an attempt to make change. Certainly some people make change by responding to requests for comments. Some people make change by writing to their senators. Some people lobby in the media. It's all an attempt to address things that we're hoping to address on all sides. I mean, you mentioned some situations before that I have to avoid, like I said, individual fact scenarios. So I wasn't maybe as clear there, but overall, everybody's trying to make the system better. And I respect all of those views. And so when it comes to the narrative, I will say, I don't think that there are a whole bunch of quote unquote bad patents out there. Is there behavior where people are trying to extend the patent claims to something that was never envisioned by the patent? Yes, that's happening. And I think that's a lot of what people see when they talk about patent trolls is not necessarily legitimate activity where somebody has a patent, maybe purchased a patent, and is trying to assert it within the realm of what was patented, but somebody who's really trying to read a patent on technology it doesn't cover, or trying to stretch claims in a way that that were never meant to be stretched. Is that happening? Yes. Is that something we're trying to address? We are. It's through the robust and reliable patents. We want to work on the clarity of the record to give the judges more tools so they can dismiss some of these cases earlier. And I think that'll solve a lot of the problems.
Dan, your thoughts about the overall reputation of the PTAB, where it stands right now? Do you think it's fair, unfair?
Well, I think as with anything, people are going to voice their opinion either because they want to make change or for whatever reason in terms of what they want to achieve through the press. So some of the statements out there I don't think are fair. I do respect any comments that are really grounded in facts and that really try and move the needle forward. I think that's very positive. In terms of the PTAB, I will say the judges are working right alongside me. They have the same goals in mind. Can we make the system better? Absolutely. Will we do it? Absolutely. But we don't need to hear some of the comments in order to effect change that these judges are, I mean, if you've met them, Eli, you know, they're some of the most reputable people you know. They want to get it right. They work around the clock. They work really hard. They're smart. They understand the technology. And, you know, these are people that the PTO hired from, you know, in-house counsel that were doing a phenomenal job that people respected, people from law firms that people respected. So I think overall, this is one of the greatest groups of lawyers I've ever worked with. And if anything in the news suggests otherwise or suggests they have anything in mind other than getting to the right answer, that would be they'd be misleading people on that.
All the PTAB judges that I know personally, I know, talk about how they want to get it right. That's their viewpoint, although the background they have, I guess maybe that's the concern that people have about whether they have the tools to do that. This is Director Kappa saying, you know, he doesn't think that PTAP has worked out as intended. And I know it's a little broad, but I think what he's talking about is, you know, the idea of the PTAP was you'd have alternative, cheaper, easier way to determine the validity of a patent instead of dealing with district court. I guess now the concern is, it's just a parallel proceeding. It's happening too often, too frequently. And if you look statistically, if you go to the PTAB, you know, chances are that your patent is going to be invalidated. Do you think there are too many post-grant proceedings? Let me put it that way.
Well, so let me just say, it's not statistically, the stats are much different. It's not that your patent's likely going to be invalidated. So I would encourage people to look beyond what they may see in the news and to actually go to our website that actually provides all the statistics. In terms of the number of proceedings, I don't have a particular opinion on that per se. I will say, are there things that a lot of people would like to see change to help conform the PTAB a little bit more to the original intent? We've heard from people on that. As you may know, we did the request for comment on even on FinTIP denials and discretionary denials. We received 822 comments. So people are very interested in this. What I will say is we are working within the USPTO to help evolve the PTAB a bit so that it more clearly aligns with our mission and vision as the PTO and with the original intent from the AIA. Some of that we're doing through guidance, which I've issued some guidance on FinTIP. There will be additional guidance likely coming out, and then we're going to go into rulemaking. So people will get the opportunity to comment on how we can evolve the PTAB when it comes to the rulemaking that we're hoping to get out relatively shortly.
With regards to discretionary denials, do you think there's any... It seems like it's going back and forth, right? There weren't a lot of discretionary denials. Then there were a lot. Now there's, again, not a lot of discretionary denials. Does that concern you, I guess, that the pendulum swinging back and forth with regards to that specific issue?
So I will say that, to me, the system needs to be clear. And so people need to understand the rules, the logic around discretionary denials. So that's what we attempted to do when we revised the first, when I provided the first guidance on FinTIP, was to say, instead of having a number of factors and having, you know, judges weigh those, we should really indicate the way they should be weighed so that stakeholders know, they know how to make decisions based on that. And they can ensure that no matter which panel they get, there'll be consistency. So we're going to continue to do more in that regard. I think that's important, not only at the USPTO, but everywhere when it comes to the law, that the more certainty and clarity the public has and the more certainty and clarity any judicial group has, the better the group can perform. So with that, I'm hoping that we're not going to see a lot of changes once we go into rulemaking, that not only will rulemaking lock this down more so that we'll have a path for going forward, but we'll get feedback from stakeholders so that we lock it down in the right way.
You're the first USPTO director, I think, who has the power of a director review. And when the Supreme Court came out with that decision to give the director that power or that responsibility, a lot of people were like, well, how's the USPTO director going to do that? Because it's such a busy job. There's hundreds of judges who are deciding these cases. On a practical level, can you tell us how did you decide how active you should be in terms of doing director review?
So I will say that I want to be as active as is necessary to make sure that we're being clear with what's happening at the PTAB. And so initially, there were some important issues that I needed to take up. As I see additional issues percolate where it makes sense to issue a decision and make it precedential versus guidance or some other mechanism for ensuring consistency and clarity, then I'll take things up. I would hope that after time with rulemaking, with, you know, clear rules and guidance on how the PTAB does things, there should be less of a need for director review. There may be a need for error correction here and there. I don't see many of them. The PTAB does a phenomenal job. So it's very rarely that I would consider something more along the lines of error correction. But I would say that, you know, overall, that's the process we're taking, and I think it's working.
My understanding is mostly about PTAB judges operate kind of consistently, not that every single decision would have been decided the way the director would have decided, right? It's a former versus the letter.
Absolutely. So, I mean, these judges should be independent. I made that clear even in the beginning with director review that I'm not talking to them about their decisions. If they come out a certain way on the facts, I'm not going to second guess them on decisions. They're smart. They put in the work, and they're doing a phenomenal job. So overall, it's more the higher level things where there is no policy set yet. There is no guidance yet. And they're either interpreting a number of factors and trying to figure out how to weigh them without guidance on that, or they're interpreting Federal Circuit case law. Whatever it is, if it's something where it's within their power, then of course I'm going to defer to them and not second guess.
And it is part of your responsibility now to have a director review. But I guess if you were designing the system from scratch, obviously there were some conversation about who knows what the Supreme Court would have done, but would you have built in that power for the director to have that director review, or is it something that you think the PTAB should be independent?
I don't know that I have a particular view on that. I will say the way that it's operating right now is working, and I think it's helping ensure consistency and clarity. So whether some other system could achieve the same advantages, there may be a different way of doing it. But I do think it's important anytime you have that many judges, you have some way of ensuring that there's clarity and consistency across the judges.
I don't want to talk about any specific case. Obviously, there's a lot of conversation about the PTAB, but just on a very high level, third parties are able to get involved in the PTAB process. They can challenge patents and so forth. What do you think about that ability? Do you think it's a healthy part of a system, or do you think should that be reined in?
So I think what's more important is what does the public think about that? So that is something that we're going to solicit input on when we go through rulemaking. That's why we're starting with an ANPRM, an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. So it won't be specific proposals where we're just looking for, you know, input on it. It'll be more open-ended questions so we can find out what others think about it.
That's interesting. So it seems like, you know, you're open to the idea of maybe the PTAB should have a different role in terms of the cases they take and so forth. That's not a kind of a, you haven't decided everything about it, that's still an open conversation.
Yeah, I think for a lot of the questions that you're asking, they're ones where we did get that input on FINTIV and discretionary denials, but now we want to drill down a little more deeper and think about what changes could be made so that the system works even better. And that's what we're going to rely on stakeholder feedback on.
Okay, great. All right, so Section 101, I think you said that about the revised guidance, that so far has been working pretty well. Lots of improvement in terms of how the examiners operate. What do you think is not working in terms of the revised guidance?
Yeah, so here's a couple things I would say on 101. So number one, just the 101 jurisprudence overall is something that needs more clarity. And so we are working with senators on that. You know that Senator Tillis introduced a bill. Senator Coons is working with him on that. So we are definitely providing guidance on that. Technical assistant is what it's called on that. We've also got two cases right now at the Supreme Court, interactive wearables and TROP. So we're certainly chiming in on that as well. In terms of the guidance, the reason I asked for comments on it was because the last guidance was put into place in 2019. I know the MPEP has been updated since, but it's time to relook at it and say, is there any way it can be improved? And if so, we'll make those improvements. The other thing that we need to do is make sure we're capturing all the right cases so that the judges can do the same pattern recognition, so can the examiners, the same pattern recognition that the courts get to do by looking at cases and determining, does this fit more into this fact profile or a different one. So in terms of 101, we did get the comments back, and I want to thank everybody who did comment on that. Really appreciate that. The team has already compiled a summary of those and is and has some advice on that, and that's something that I'm looking at right now.
I guess about the fact pattern piece, there's substantial disagreement even on the Federal Circuit about what the fact pattern is. You actually see decisions that don't necessarily take account every other decision that every other Federal Circuit panel took. Is it realistic for examiners to be able to engage in that kind of their own fact pattern recognition based on all the cases that are out there? Is that a realistic kind of goal?
Well, and that's a really good question, Eli. So we're not going to list every case that's out there. We're going to be very careful in the cases that we list so they can do appropriate fact pattern recognition.
There's a new commissioner of patents. Can you give us some sense about how did you think about who should take on that role?
Yeah, and I appreciate that. So what I did was, and it took us a while to fill that role, to even list the position, in part because I wanted to hear from those in the examining corps. I wanted to hear from those in patents on how the system was working and what needed to be improved. So I started using my lunch hour to have small listening sessions with examiners across the agency. I also did that in other areas of the agency as well. And what I heard from over 1,000 in the patents group about things that they thought worked better at different times, that were working now, things that could be improved. And once I figured all that out, and I will say I worked with the unions very closely on that. Kathy Duda attended all my sessions. Once I figured that out, it really helped me think about the future of the patents group, what that needed to look like, and the type of leader that I thought could effectively lead that type of change. A lot of it is working extremely well when it comes to training. A lot of the operations is working really well. Routing and classification needed improvements. I've already made some improvements in that area to make sure examiners are getting the right applications, that it's not unduly burdensome for them to get an application off their desk if they feel like it's not a good fit, so it can get to the right examiner. I've worked on, areas where there needs to be more collaboration if there's two technologies that are converging, right? If you have a biotech degree, but you don't know AI and you get a patent application that has both in it, you need to be able to consult with somebody. So what I was looking for was somebody to carry on that work that I'd already started and really work with the group. The deputies are phenomenal. They are so experienced, so thoughtful. Everything that they're doing is just incredible, and was looking for somebody to team with them and really run it from an organizational standpoint and think about all the things we just talked about, but also, how do we hire? How do we retain? How do we ensure the health and wellness of our group that's dispersed throughout the entire United States? How do we keep them connected with each other in the mission and vision? So that's what I was looking for, was a leader that could really move that forward.
And some of the things you mentioned, routing, classification, those are very technical issues that seems like it would help to know how the bureaucracy works. And traditionally, Commissioner of USPTO has been somebody who has worked at the USPTO for a long time. Is there a specific reason why you want to go outside of the USPTO for that role?
So I will say that for a lot of the roles, we've got two postings now, which we're opening it up inside and external to the PTO. That's what we did for that one as well. It was opened up both within the USPTO and externally. In government, there's a series of processes that happen before I even see candidates. So, and I don't see all the candidates who have applied for the position. I will say that with Vaishali, the new commissioner for patents, and the rest of the deputies, it's a really good mix. I was not afraid to go outside of the USPTO because even with the work that I had been doing, I worked with Andy Phil very closely, and the work that I was doing on routing and classification, on collaboration, on some of the training, I realized that if somebody has the right background, was a team player, really respected the views of others, that they could easily integrate and work with the other deputies and really make amazing change. So I didn't really have a preference for inside or outside the agency. It was just as the process played out, we found a great leader who can work with the other great deputies. And as a team, they're going to be incredible.
One of the criticisms that I've heard is that Vaishali Duppa is obviously a very impressive candidate, and it's amazing that the USPTO attracted her, but she's like Kathy Vidal number two, in terms of background and perspective and so forth. Did you have concerns about that? I don't know if you think that's fair, but I guess, and I see you're, maybe you don't agree, but let me drill down on it. I guess, and I don't think it's a fair characterization of your background. When people think of your background, they think of you defending companies in patent litigation. if they look at her background, it's pretty similar in that sense. Did you have a concern that you're too similar?
So that's funny that the criticism is it's another Kathy Vidal.
I didn't mean to take like that. Just the fact.
I'm just giving you a hard time. I'm just giving you a hard time. So first of all, I love to hear people's views on everything. And I will say that I looked more deeply than that at what she brought to the table. I looked at the varying roles that she would play. This is someone, if you haven't heard, she wanted to be a patent examiner right from the beginning. So she applied to be a patent examiner. And then she found out that because she was a Canadian citizen, she couldn't be. So she immediately got her citizenship, went back to the USPTO, and we had a hiring freeze at that time, or we just weren't hiring examiners at that time. She's applied for other positions at the USPTO. She was willing to come in a number of different roles just to help move the country forward. So we've had a lot of discussions on that. She believes in the small inventor. She wants to make sure the system works. She believes in everything that I'm working on with inclusive innovation to make sure we get out into communities, that we support those who need access to the innovation ecosystem. That's been, if I realize what my background was before, which quite frankly, yes, I did represent companies, but I did represent a lot of startups as well. Yeah. And I did a lot of work in that space. But if you look at the work that I'm focused on here, it's all about how do we create a great ecosystem? How do we support smaller companies? How do we support startups? How do we incentivize that competition that really makes America great? She's aligned with that as well. And I think that, and I will say, so is everybody else at the USPTO. So to the extent that she's similar to me, it's more that she's someone who was willing and wanting to change careers and really focus on what's best for the country. It had nothing to do with, I want to go support the last company I happen to work for, I want to support prior clients. So I think she's the right person for that reason. And if people are doing pattern recognition based on backgrounds, then they're missing the bigger picture, which I think most people see the bigger picture and will see it even more clearly as we move forward.
Have you learned anything that has kind of surprised you being in the USPTO role about the patent system, about the innovation? Anything you haven't thought about before you took on the role?
So I will say that the one thing that surprised and delighted me is that all of our allies have the same goals in mind. That in November, we did our trilats with Japan and Europe, and we were all focused on small to medium-sized enterprises. So everything that I came here working on and wanting to work on, the great work Congress is doing on this, we're all aligned, and other countries, our allies are aligned as well, that we need to get out there. We need to support more innovation from more people. We've got a lot of world problems we need to solve. And so I was delighted that we're completely aligned in that, including on the SDGs at the UN, the Sustainable Development Goals, that there's key things that we need to do across the world and that there's so much alignment on that. So I was both surprised only because I hadn't thought about it and I thought that we were taking a creative approach, but also very, very delighted to work with my colleagues in other countries to advance the same mission and vision.
That's very interesting. So not only in the U.S. government, there seems to be a lot of alignment, but also internationally, everybody's thinking about, our major allies are thinking about the same kind of things.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's why this is the time, right? This is a time because we're in alignment. We know what needs to be done and we're here to get it done.
You know, I didn't spend too much time talking about your impressive biography. Obviously, we talked about that a lot during our last interview, but somebody might look at your life. You went to college at 16. You went to an Ivy League law school. You became editor-in-chief of the law review there. You became the head of a litigation group at, you know, one of the most significant IP firms in the world. And then you became, obviously, the managing partner at Winston & Strawn. It seems like one success after the other, after another, you know, like Kathy Vidal can't fail at anything she does. I wanted to ask you, maybe the answer is, there is no answer to this, but have you had any setback and in your career now that you're risen to the top of the field? And is there any advice that you can share with somebody about dealing with a setback?
So I love that. And of course I have. I mean, I think any leader who tells you they haven't, I can't imagine somebody who hasn't had a setback. And I saw something recently on social media that said something about, you know, great leaders have bad mornings, sometimes procrastinate, have things that don't go well. Like, it was a whole list.
So is that true?
It is. It's absolutely true. And sometimes it's a matter of degree, but it's absolutely true. So I will tell one story just to kind of drill this home is, when I did my first patent application, I thought that I was going with a partner to a company to listen to how to conduct a patent interview, because I was new. I'd come from the federal circuit. I hadn't done one before. And then when I got back, I thought everything went well. And then 6 months later, I got my review and it said, Kathy Vidal is very timid. She doesn't speak up. all of these statements in there. And then I kept getting that on my review for like 4 or 5 years. And I kept saying, was that back in 1990, blah, when, that one examiner interview? And so I will just say it teaches you a couple things. One, we all have to face that it's sometimes, whether it's now in the press getting something not perfectly accurate, or whether it was, that situation where it was repeated over and over again. What I learned from that was a couple things. One, don't take it personally. I mean, I did beat myself up. I was not mature or didn't have the wisdom to know not to take it personally, but also own it. So don't take it personally. You shouldn't feel bad about it, but own it. And so here's an opportunity to show that I'm different. And maybe that helped change me on my career path. Who knows? I mean, I didn't think I was timid then. Nobody that I knew would have said that I was timid then, but maybe that had an impact. So you also have to own other people's perceptions, right? And do what you can. At a certain point, don't take it personally, because there's only so much you can do. But realize that these things happen. People, everybody has setbacks. Everybody makes mistakes here and there. And the big thing is what you do after that. And you shouldn't look at yourself any differently. You still have the same trajectory for wherever you want to go in life. And there's no reason, like I said, to take it personally or feel bad about it, because there's just, life's too short for that.
Well, that's great wisdom right there. Thank you so much, Director Kathy Vidal. We really appreciate your time, and thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Eli. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. I'd also like to thank my firm, Harity & Harity LLP, for their generous support. Clause 8 is produced by Great Feeling Studios and Brick Brewer. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Thanks for listening.